Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Marty Johnson reporting. The Ukrainian military says it has cleared pro-Russian rebels from much of the Donetsk airport in a massive overnight operation. The fighting killed four soldiers today in the bloody months-long battle for control of the facility. Ukraine rushed fresh troops and supplies to the key airport near the Russian border as violence escalated in recent days. On Friday, a Ukrainian military spokesman said six servicemen had been killed and 18 wounded in the preceding 24 hours. The conflict began in April when rebels in the Russian-speaking East launched an uprising against Ukrainian rule. Meantime, in Niger, police used tear gas to break up a banned opposition protest in the capital, Niamey. Several hundred demonstrators gathered there today for a long-planned march that was organized before riots over the publication of the French magazine depicting Islam's prophet. But Niger authorities banned the demonstration following 2 days of violent protests. An opposition alliance organized the march to protest bad governance in the West African nation. On Friday, five people died in church fires and violent fighting in the capital city. In the Islamic State-held regions of Syria and Iraq, the Islamic State group has released at least 200 Yazidis after 5 months of captivity. This was one of the men released. Officials say almost all of those let go were elderly or sick. This man says his group, several of them, are still being held captive, and they don't know the whereabouts of the remainder of their people or their children. Islamic State fighters attacked Yazidis in August, forcing thousands of them to flee to Sinjar Mountain. Israel says it has broken up an Islamic State cell in the occupied West Bank. Israel's domestic intelligence agency says it arrested seven Arabs on terrorism-related offenses in November and December, but kept the information on gag order until indictments were issued. This is VOA News. Pope Francis delivered Mass for millions of Filipinos gathered under a steady rain in Manila's Rizal Park and surrounding areas today, the final day of his four-day visit to the Philippines. During his homily, Francis urged Filipinos to reject social structures which perpetuate ignorance, corruption, and poverty, and talked about the value of women in the world through an interpreter.
Las mujeres tienen mucho que decirnos en la sociedad de hoy.
Women have much to tell us in today's society.
A veces somos demasiado machistas.
Sometimes we're too machistas.
Y no dejamos lugar a la mujer.
And we don't allow room for the woman.
Pero la mujer es capaz.
Nearly 80 million Roman Catholics live in the Philippines, of which 4 to 6 million attended today. 50,000 Philippine soldiers and police were called in to protect the Pope during his visit because two other popes visiting the Philippines were both targets of assassination attempts. Thousands of people displaced by floods in southern Malawi have sought shelter at a camp there in an area set up by aid agencies, while thousands more are still stranded without aid as rains continue to hamper the rescue efforts by the country's army. Flash floods caused by days of torrential rains have swept away roads and bridges and destroyed thousands of hectares of crops and raised fears of a cholera outbreak in the southern half of Malawi. The Weather Service predicts more rain in the next 2 to 3 weeks, and neighboring Mozambique is also badly hit, with one major road destroyed and the South African military helping to search for missing people. A U.S. congressional delegation is in Cuba, the first such visit since President Barack Obama announced last month that Washington would normalize relations with Havana. Among the visitors, Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
I just think that we're just seeing a remarkable change in relations between our countries, and we want to talk with some of the Cubans, see what they think about it. See what's going to happen next.
The six-member group of Democrats want to explore further opportunities for greater cooperation, but they understand there are still big differences between the countries. The Obama administration on Friday began implementing rule changes aimed at loosening trade restrictions. President Obama will announce that he wants to raise taxes on the wealthiest Americans and the largest financial firms in his upcoming State of the Union address on Tuesday. The proposals are outlined in a White House press release and likely won't pass the Republican-controlled Congress, but are more to highlight the differences between the Democratic and the Republican parties going into the campaign season ahead of next year's presidential election. I'm Marty Johnson reporting from Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
We recognize the freedom of expression and the freedom of media, but we recognize also the freedom of religion.
The government of Niger bans the distribution of Charlie Hebdo over a major security concern.
There have been some shortfalls here and there. We are still using this weekend to make sure that districts that maybe do not have adequate supplies of what they need are being attended to.
The Electoral Commission of Zambia says it is ready to administer a transparent and credible poll on Tuesday.
They have crossed the boundary, and tomorrow I have called to the Ministry of Communication so that we can put up communication, because the Cameroonians have to know what is happening. We will tell to the population.
And Chadian troops arrive in Cameroon to help fight Boko Haram. We'll have a report. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. A prominent member of the ruling Nigerian Party for Democracy and Socialism, or PNDS Taraya, says the government decision to ban the distribution of the Charlie Hebdo newspaper is to ensure peace and stability in the Muslim-dominated West African country. Sani Iro, the communications director for PNDS Taraya, told me that some churches in Zinder in the Damagaram region were touched by irate Muslim youth following the latest publication of Charlie Hebdo in France.
This is a measure that the government took because, as you know, our country is in majority Muslim population. So these cartoons are offensive to the Islam religion. And the population cannot understand that such a cartoon may be allowed in our country. This is why the government took this measure and banned the cartoons.
But the Constitution guarantees freedom of expression and freedom of speech. Banning this infringes on the journalistic freedom of expression that the Constitution guarantees.
We recognize the freedom of expression and the freedom of media, but we recognize also the freedom of religion and the freedom of worship. So if any kind of freedom has a limit, and the limit of freedom finishes where the freedom of someone's honor begins. So because of that, even if there is freedom of expression, you know that there are some things that do not be allowed in a society for the sake of serenity, of peace. You see in Europe, in France, that they are now bringing to trial people who are claiming the apology of terrorism. So you see, it's despite the freedom of expression, but there are people, because they expressed the apology of terrorism, they have to swear by law. It's the same thing in this country. If there is an expression that will bring trouble in the country, it's the role of the government to prevent the troubles in this country. And I am telling you, you should take the information. There's a town in our country where today the population has burned churches and Christian houses in Zinder just because of this cartoon.
Are you therefore saying that reproducing this cartoon in Niger and across the country by any media organization threatens the security of the people and the stability of the country?
Yes, I'm telling you now, as we are talking, there is a town in our country where the population to protest against this cartoon raised and went to burn churches and Christian houses.
Has the government sent troops to stop this from going on? Are they protecting other minority religious groups in the country because of this cartoon?
Yeah, just to prevent these troubles and to make sure that peace is reigning in the country.
Sunny Iro is the communications director for PNDS Taraya. He spoke with me from the Nigerian capital, Niamey. A senior official of the Electoral Commission of Zambia, ECZ, says it's ready to organize a credible presidential by-election on Tuesday. Official campaign ends on Monday ahead of the poll. Priscilla Isaac, the director of elections at ECZ, told me that both sensitive and non-sensitive materials have been dispatched to ensure that all polling centers across the country open on time for the election.
There have been some shortfalls here and there. We are still using this weekend to make sure that districts that maybe do not have adequate supplies of what they need are being attended to, because in some cases we had, and understandably, late delivery by some suppliers because of the short notice that we had in which to procure large quantities of some of the items that we did not have some sufficient stocks of. So, but anyway, we've really tried to be on top of things, and we'll be ready to open polling stations on time on the 20th.
How about the ballot papers that will be used for the election? Are they ready?
Oh, yes, yes. We received them last weekend. And in fact, I was in South Africa the previous week to see the closing part of the printing with our chairperson, Justice Mambirima. And we received the ballot papers last Saturday. And then we proceeded to begin the final verification with our field officers and political parties. We started that on Sunday. And we dispatched the last set of ballot papers to the districts. That was Thursday. So all the ballot papers are now in all the districts and just waiting now for the deployment to the respective polling stations with the polling staff. In fact, some districts began the deployment on Thursday for those that need to be accessed by air. And we know that everybody will be in place by the 19th. At all their respective polling stations in readiness for the polls on Tuesday.
Were the political parties pleased with the verification process? Because I heard recently the Electoral Commission summoned one opposition member who's been making allegations that the election could be rigged. So were they pleased with the verification process?
Yes, they were. They were with us throughout the verification process. We only had a slight setback when the arrival time for the ballot papers changed. Instead of arriving at about 3 o'clock on Friday afternoon, it seems the airline had some logistical challenges. The printer had chartered a plane. The ballot papers arrived shortly before midnight on Friday night. So it was a long wait, I must say, for us and the political party representatives who were at the airport. But the ballot papers arrived intact, and I think everybody understood that sometimes there are these logistical challenges which are beyond our control. It was not our intention that the ballot papers should arrive so late.
There are concerns of political violence in the run-up to the election. A lot of these political parties have expressed concern about cadres attacking each other. Has the Electoral Commission come out to warn these parties to urge their supporters not to engage in violence ahead of the election on Tuesday?
Yes, we did have a meeting with the Secretary Generals of the participating political parties on Tuesday, and we were particularly concerned with the PF and UPND because it's basically them that have been involved in skirmishes between their cadres and supporters. And following that, during that meeting, you know, all the political parties made a pledge to promote peace for campaigns and also to ensure that they would restrain their cadres and supporters from violence. And following that meeting, which pleased us very much, both presidents for PF and UPND made a public commitment that they would not support any violence from any of their supporters, calling upon their supporters that even if they're provoked, they should restrain themselves from from provoking their colleagues. So we are hoping that with only two more days to go for campaigns, which is tomorrow and Monday, that we will not get any more incidences of violence. The police have been very proactive and following up cases, and we had asked the police to ensure that they treat everybody the same. Whoever is found to be wanting in terms of violence should be treated the same. Nobody should be spared, but dealt with in accordance with the law.
What assurances will you give Zambian prospective voters about the Electoral Commission's ability to administer a credible, transparent election on Tuesday?
I would say, Peter, that the Zambian electorate and stakeholders in general have seen for themselves that we have improved tremendously in our management of the process. 2011, we had a credible election, and we have a history of two instances of power changing hands, and it has been done peacefully.
Priscilla Isaac is the Director of Elections at the Electoral Commission of Zambia. She spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. The family of Colonel Patrick Karegeya, the slain former Rwandan intelligence chief, has launched a foundation in his name today. This to mark a year's anniversary since his murder in South Africa. David Patenga is Colonel Karegeya's nephew, who was also the first person to see his lifeless body in South African hotel room where he was killed. Mr. Patenga joins us live via telephone link from Boston, the U.S. state of Massachusetts, where the foundation is being launched. Hello, David.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm well, thank you. David, now tell me about this foundation to honor your uncle's legacy.
Well, ideally, the foundation is meant to uphold the basic principles that he believed in. That would include human rights to each and every person, and more importantly, the elements of how a human being should be able to live. You know, you have a right to life, you have a right to a country, you have a right to exist within the communities, within the society. And that's what we are trying to bring to attention to most of the people around here. And even back in the country where he was, where he's from, it is going to be taking place today. And we urge each and everyone to come and be part and parcel of this process.
He became a significant opposition leader in the diaspora. Will this foundation be politically affiliated, as you enumerated about the significance of this foundation?
Not at all. Over and above his political affiliations, he was a father, he was a citizen, and he was a friend to many. So it is no political connotation at all. It is a foundation which deals with basic human rights. It is the element of education to most people. You know, he had a strong interest in children, and education principles were very vital to him. So that's what we're going to be focusing on, not political oriented.
How is the family holding on a year ago since his murder in South Africa?
It's been tough. It's not going to be easy. It's been 12 months down the line now since we laid him to rest. And till to date, of course, there's so no much that has happened to vindicate the memory. And it's going to be very painful, of course, for the forthcoming years to come. But I think what we have to understand from today is the fact that despite of everything, you know, we have to celebrate his achievement. We have to celebrate his life. We have to celebrate his legacy. And that's what we're focusing on today.
Now, I understand South Africa just concluded an investigation into your uncle's murder, in this case, Colonel Patrick Karegeya. Are you aware of this report, and do you know, or are you privy to this report?
Not to the extent of media Yes, I have a bit of information regarding that, and I think it is still highly sensitive document or file to deal with, and we prefer to keep it that way until when the date is set for the court and the proceedings.
Have all his assailants supposedly been arrested by the South African authorities?
None as yet, none that I know of.
So if I may ask you, what do you see as the prospect of this foundation that was established today?
It's very positive indeed. I mean, people have phoned in from different corners of the earth to be part and parcel of this event. And as you may know well, he was very a noble person, very a person who had friends from all corners, all walks of life, and everyone would want to be part and parcel of this day.
Let me ask you this, last but not the least. How safe is the family following his murder?
Well, that's something that is in everyone's mind. Of course, no one can ever say that they are safe. You know, even he himself, he never knew that he would be safe. But needless to say, we just believe that when it's your day indeed. And I think the only way you can do is just keep living your day as it comes by, because you can never put yourself in a position where, you know, your life will stop. Because we believe that, you know, if God has said it's over, then it has to be over. So there's really no safety as it may be. There are no measures in place to protect the family till to date. But we hope that we be able to manage.
Thank you very much, David. David Batenga is the nephew of Colonel Patrick Karegeya, the slain former Rwandan intelligence chief. He joined us live from Boston in the U.S. state of Massachusetts. Thousands of Chadian troops have arrived in Cameroon to help the Central African nation fight the Nigerian terrorist Boko Haram. For VOA, Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from the Cameroonian capital, Yaoundé.
Cameroon State Radio journalist Said Abdul Karim, who is based in the town of Kuseri on the border with Chad, told VOA in a telephone interview that thousands of Chadian soldiers came into Cameroon in a convoy of military trucks Saturday morning. He says the soldiers passed through the Chadian town of Bongor and got into Cameroon through the northern town of Yagwa and are on their way to Marwa, where they will work together with Cameroonian forces. He says there was a big event in Chad to demonstrate solidarity with Cameroon in fighting Boko Haram. Colonel Dide Bajek, spokesperson for Cameroon's military, says the soldiers will head for Marwa in northern Cameroon, where they will be deployed to the war zone on the border with Nigeria. He says they will work with Cameroonian soldiers to crush Boko Haram incursions in Cameroon.
They have crossed the boundary, and tomorrow I have called to the Ministry of Communications so that we can put up communication, because the Cameroonians have to know what is happening. We will tell to the population.
He says the soldiers have crossed the boundary and are on their way to the town of Marwa in northern Cameroon, and that he has given the information to the Minister of Communication so that Cameroonians along the road the soldiers are using should not panic. Chad said last Wednesday that it would support Cameroon, whose president, Paul Biya, had appealed for a coordinated international response to Boko Haram. Mr. Biya did not say when nor how many troops would be deployed in this Thursday's announcement. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé.
UN figures show that even as the African continent is experiencing unprecedented economic growth, over 200 million people in sub-Saharan Africa live in extreme poverty. Paul O'Brien is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam. He tells VOA's Jackson Mvungani that the report demonstrates the impact of rising inequality and calls on governments to confront the factors that sustain it.
Africa is one of the contexts where we are concerned. You have 7 of the 10 fastest growing countries in the world in Africa, but you also have half the countries with the greatest share of extreme poor. So what does that mean? It means that countries are experiencing economic growth. They're seeing those oil, minerals, gas revenues going up. They're seeing greater investment. But where is the money going? Our concern is that it's not going to development in many African countries. It's not going to provide enough basic health care, education, and economic opportunity to build inclusive growth.
Okay. Is this something that can be solved during our lifetime? Is it something that can be dealt with?
Absolutely. We believe that extreme inequality can be tackled with practical and sensible policies that shift the rules around how resources get allocated and how economies grow. We're calling for 5 things in particular. We want to see tax loopholes closed for the extreme wealthy and for corporations. We want to see the natural wealth of countries stay in those countries and be used to drive healthy economies. We want to see the minimum wage raised in all countries, including here in the United States. We want to tackle the gender gap tackled, meaning we want to see women and men earn the same amount for the same work. Today, there's only 1 country in the world where that happens. And interestingly, the United States ranks 65th in terms of closing the gender gap. And we want to make sure that investments are made with those monies from tax, from oil, minerals and gas, in healthcare and education. Finally, I would say that what we really want to see in Africa is robust national conversations about the quality of their economic experience, of their growth. What we're concerned about is that if too much of these monies are captured by political elites, by economic elites, and they fear a robust national conversation, we're going to see more and more civil society space closing. Mm-hmm. And if that happens, you're not going to have a meaningful national dialogue about how to make their economy stronger.
All right, so when we talk about income inequality, we always think in terms of rich man, poor man. But inequality also has other ways of manifesting itself. Why don't you give us some of the ways inequality shows in a society?
Well, first, let me say one thing about the old rich man, poor man dichotomy. Things are changing in that front alone. It's really interesting for us to see the kinds of spokespeople that are stepping up to the plate. You had Bill Gates blogging about inequality last week. Warren Buffett, a billionaire, who says that he pays less taxes than his secretary, and that's wrong. He says there's been a class war going on for the last 20 years, and his class has won. You see President Obama, the Pope, the head of the IMF, all talking about the problem of inequality and what it's doing to our societies, what it's doing to our economies. So I think that old dichotomy of this is a battle between the rich and the poor is actually breaking down. This is striking at the heart of countries, of their economies, and of their polities. But you're absolutely right. It's not just about income inequality. We have for years been an organization that faces all forms of inequality and injustice associated with it, whether it's racial inequality, national inequality, ethnic inequality. The one for us perhaps that we have focused most on and we want to see integrated into this campaign is gender inequality, where there are different sets of rules and rewards for men and women in the economic marketplace, but also in political spaces as well.
Paul O'Brien is the Vice President of Policy and Advocacy at Oxfam. He spoke with viewers Jackson Mvungani here in Washington, D.C.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in Africa news, features, and sports. We are also available on the Internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington, D.C. Coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, sports with Segun Adeyemi from the Nigerian commercial capital, Lagos, and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sport, and for that, let's go to Lagos, Nigeria, and join Segun Adeyemi. Good evening, Segun.
Good evening, Peter, and good evening, Africa. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports for Sunday, January 18th. The 2015 Africa Cup of Nations kicked off in Equatorial Guinea on Saturday. The 30th edition of the two-yearly African football extravaganza started with two matches in the port city of Bata. Equatorial Guinea took over as Nations Cup host from Morocco, which was stripped of the hosting rights in October when it asked for a postponement over Ebola fears. 16 teams are participating in the three-week tournament that will run through February 8th. In the opening game, host Equatorial Guinea was denied victory by Congo Brazzaville after both played 1-1. A sellout crowd of 35,000 turned out for the Group A game. The hosts, who had just 2 months to prepare after being catapulted into the 16-team finals, missed a potentially famous win as they gave up a late goal. Equatorial Guinea opened scoring in the 17th minute through English-based captain Emilio Unsue, but the hosts allowed Congo to dominate the last 20 minutes of the game, and the inevitable equalizer followed 3 minutes from the end. It was a heartbreaking reversal for an overcapacity crowd who jammed the stairwells and aisle of the stands at the 35,000 capacity stadium after many had broken through a gate leading into the stadium. Equatorial Guinea's new coach Esteban Becker had just 2 weeks to prepare the national team for the game. Former Spanish international Andoni Goycochea was replaced by the Argentine-born Becker, who was coach of Equatorial Guinea's women's team. Equatorial Guinea remains in battle for its next match on Wednesday against Burkina Faso, which finished runner-up at the last Nations Cup, but lost its opening game 2-0 to Gabon on Saturday. Pierre-Emerick Aubameyang and Malik Evouna were on targets as Gabon beat Burkina Faso with a goal in each half. Borussia Dortmund striker Aubameyang confirmed his potential to become the next African superstar with a cool finish after 19 minutes, and Evouna headed home just under 20 minutes from time to secure a hard-fought win. And President Teodoro Obiang Nguema of the Central African Nation of Equatorial Guinea said on Saturday that his country was proud to host the Africa Cup of Nations, quote, despite criticism from our enemies, unquote. Speaking at the opening ceremony, President Nguema said Equatorial Guinea warmly welcomes the sporting youth of Africa and modestly offers its contribution and its hospitality. The president's speech was loudly applauded by the home fans who filled the Estadio do Bata, where the Nzalang National, as the country's national team is known, were held to a 1-1 draw by Congo. The home fans then gave a rousing rendition of the country's national anthem prior to the match, which was attended by the president of Gabon, Congo Brazzaville, Togo, Mali, and the Central African Republic. Equatorial Guinea was only named as host in November 2014, after original host Morocco stepped down due to fears over the spread of Ebola as the virus ravages parts of West Africa. As President Nguema was beating his chest over the hosting of the Nations Cup, Congo coach Claude Roy was criticizing the tournament organizers. The Congolese team spent more than 1 hour fighting through traffic to reach the stadium for the tournament's opening match. Leroy said the bus drive from the hotel that previously took 12 minutes, this time lasted 65 minutes, as the team battled through traffic heading to the match against Equatorial Guinea at the Estadio do Bata. The coach said, and I quote, it was close to 40 degrees and we had no air conditioning in the bus. We were supposed to have an escort, but they left us in the crowd in a big traffic jam. The police were just smiling, end of quote. Leroy, who had previously complained about hotel and training conditions, said his team arrived only 20 minutes before its warm-up period. Congo went behind to a 17th-minute goal in a sluggish start, but later took control of the match to force a late equalizer. Leroy is coaching at a record 8th Africa Cup of Nations. Staying with the Nations Cup, I did mention earlier that Gabonese striker Aubameyang confirmed his potential to become the next African superstar with a goal for his country in his 2-0 win over Burkina Faso in the second Group A game on Saturday. After overcoming the trauma of his last Nations Cup final appearance and the loss of the 2014 African Footballer of the Year to Ivorian Yaya Toure, Aubameyang is now one of the players to watch at the ongoing tournament. The French-born striker missed the decisive penalty in a quarter-final shootout against Mali 3 years ago when Gabon co-hosted the tournament. But his opening goal for Gabon on Saturday was a classic poacher's goal. After his way was blocked, the 25-year-old steadied himself at the second attempt before blasting home at the Estadio do Bata. He might have had a second goal with 20 minutes remaining as he burst away on the left wing, only for his shot to swing across goal. "I tried to do the maximum to become one of the greats like Drogba and Eto'o," the Borussia Dortmund star said, referring to Ivorian striker Didier Drogba and Cameroonian star Samuel Eto'o. Meanwhile, African soccer's governing body, CAF, has expressed confidence that the nation's Cup host has taken adequate measures to protect against Ebola. "We are very confident. It was one of our top priorities," assured CAF General Secretary Hicham El Amrani. "More than 8,000 people have died in the epidemic in West Africa, but no cases have been reported in Equatorial Guinea." Remember, sports fans, that Equatorial Guinea stepped in to organize the hosting of the Nations Cup after Morocco's withdrawal over Ebola fears. CAF said Equatorial Guinea has invested a lot of money in equipment, such as specialist ambulances. There is also an anti-Ebola commission, and doctors have come from other countries. El Amrani also expressed satisfaction with preparations in the four towns and cities chosen to host the games. The hosts are the capital city of Malabo, the port city of Bata, and the small towns of Mongomo and Ebebin. Still with the Nations Cup, ambitious Equatorial Guinea coach Esteban Becker has said he hopes his team can use the ongoing Nations Cup to build towards the dream of World Cup qualification. "I have always dreamt of being at a World Cup, and so all my energies will be directed at preparing our young team to have a shot at qualifying for the World Cup, and the next one will be in 2018, Becker said. 3 years ago, the coach led the Equatorial Guinea women's team to win the African Women's Championship in style. Finally, Cameroon international midfielder Landry Nguema signed for Saint-Étienne, the League One club said on Friday. The 29-year-old had been without a club since leaving Bordeaux last year. Nguema, who has scored 3 goals in 42 international appearances, began his career at Nancy before joining Bordeaux in 2011, just after a loan spell at Scottish giant Celtic. That ends it for this weekend's edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Thanks a lot for listening. I'm Segun Adeyemi in Lagos. Now sending it back to Peter Klote in Washington.
Thanks a lot, Segun. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. And you know, it's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent. Chama de lá no Nizongue.
haraka aweza kunipata. Baby usizani si ya zangu mimi, nimeumbwa kuzaga.
Oh! says she likes it when I stay. She says she don't want me to go. She says I always make her day. Girl, would you be my lover? No. She says she really likes my style. Seems like she wants to take it slow. Do anything to make her smile. Girl, would you be my lover? No. What am I to do? Tired of running around chasing you. I can never think of replacing you. It's not you I define, baby, make up your mind. Hey, would you be my lover? Yes, yes, yes. Would you be my lover? Yes, yes. And if you won't be my lover, let me know. Yes, yes. Would you be my lover? Or love for four. This guy is feeling it in my soul. So would you be my lover? No. I'm doing things I've never done. I'm giving all I have to give. I'm feeling like I found the one. Say you'll be my lover, please. What am I to say? Tired of running around, no delay. Make you no go look who Jay face. All this time you there waste, you gon' make me crazy. Would you be my lover?
When your body is calling, I'm functional. We can get close, I'm personal. Yeah, yeah. In additional, loving you is not optional. Satisfy mental critical. Baby girl, I'm a professional. I'm gonna be
loving you, loving you, loving you, loving you, baby. Yeah, yeah,
yeah. You want a good, good loving, and I'ma give it to you. I'm gonna be
baby girl, call me jailer, cause I'm a prisoner of love. Baby girl, call me Taylor, cause I will mend your broken heart. In the rain, every weather, oh, say I will love you till the end. Baby, only you, only you, we're gonna make my life complete. Baby, only you, my baby, only you. Where they see, where they make me, they happy, they make me, they smile, I lose my mind.
And that was our Sunday Music Spot. Hope you enjoy the music from Nightline Africa. Here are the English service of The Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's Wamam Point of View with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. In the context of our common humanity, it was imperative that the recent assaults in the office of the satirical French newspaper Charlie Hebdo should be condemned. Whatever the provocations, there was no justification to slaughter newspaper cartoonists, nor should anyone condone the unnecessary loss of 17 innocent lives in and around Paris. However, there should be room to discuss frankly whether the right of freedom of speech should be used to publish a number of caricatures of the Prophet Muhammad, particularly when it is inevitable that a large number of the 1.7 billion Muslims around the world would be offended. It is clear that the tragedy in Paris was so immediate and shocking that it pushed to the background such a relevant consideration. In this regard, it was understandable that we witnessed such an outpouring of solidarity with the French people last week. So much of Africa was linked in some ways with the tragedy in France. The two Kouachi brothers carried out the slaughter in the newspaper's office had Algerian connections, though Frenchmen. Amedi Coulibaly, who killed the policewoman and carried out the hostage killing in the kosher supermarket, was from Mali, but so was the young shop assistant in the supermarket that helped save the lives of Jewish shoppers. For his heroic initiative, the French president had assured him that he would receive his French citizen in good time. The common law wife of the Coulibaly comes from Morocco. Owing to this sad development in France, Western governments have a duty to guard against an overreach and demonization of the Muslim population in their midst. Already, President François Hollande of France and Chancellor Merkel of Germany have taken efforts to warn that not all Muslims should be condemned of the crime. Of course, those with different political agendas will endeavor to use the incidents to promote their anti-immigration objectives. They should not be allowed to succeed. Another challenge confronting Western governments is to urge restraint in invoking the right of freedom of speech. Even in French law and practice, there exists some limit to the freedom of speech. No one is permitted to engage in hate speech or Holocaust denial. The recent arrest of Dieudonné Mpala has caused many to accuse Europe of double standards. Pope Francis, in comments he made in the Philippines last week, argued that there should be limits to the concept of freedom of speech. He stated, quote, "You cannot provoke. You cannot insult the faith of others. You cannot make fun of the faith of others." These comments are relevant for what happened in many parts of Africa last Friday after prayer services, responding to the overreach of Charlie Hebdo when it published over 5 million copies of his papers with more cartoons. Muslims demonstrated in anger, and there was reports that in Niger, 4 people were killed. Senegal had to ban the sale of the newspapers in the country. We are now in a critical stage. We should keep watch over those who, for inordinate political reasons, would want to condemn Muslims as radical Islamists. This should be resisted. This is a time for reflection. Temper must cool, and rash statements should be avoided. The time is also opportune to look carefully to the underlying causes of international terrorism. I thank you.
Thank you very much. That was One Man's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. From the Nightline Africa team, Managing Editor Shaka Sali, Reporter Douglas Impuga, Producer Odette Frazier, Sports Editor Shegun Ademi, and Engineer for today, Brian McCullier, alias Bozo Jones, we say thanks for joining us. And remember, as the elders say, the person who moves with each day is better than another who waits for luck. I'm your host, Peter Clote, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting American ideals and institutions.
On the third Monday of each January, Americans honor the memory of the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Dr. King, a Baptist minister from the southern state of Alabama, was a leader in the U.S. civil rights movement, advocating social change through nonviolent means. On January 15th, he would have celebrated his 86th birthday. Believing that change does not roll in on the wheels of inevitability, but comes through continuous struggle, Dr. King organized and participated in mass action boycotts, sit-ins, peaceful marches, and other nonviolent acts of civil disobedience. Dr. King once stated that an individual who breaks a law that conscience tells him is unjust and who willingly accepts the penalty of imprisonment in order to arouse the conscience of the community over its injustice is in reality expressing the highest respect for the law. And so, activists sometimes deliberately, but peacefully and respectfully, broke laws aimed at segregating the white citizenry from the non-white, thus hoping to bring attention to the inherent unfairness of such legislation. Thus, when a black seamstress named Rosa Parks broke the law in Montgomery, Alabama, by refusing to give up her seat on a bus to a white passenger and subsequently was jailed for her transgression, her plight generated national attention and increasing sympathy for her cause across the country. Dr. King was 39 years old when he died by an assassin's bullet on April 4, 1968. But his legacy lives on. In the fullness of time, segregationist laws were repealed. Discrimination is a legally punishable and punished offense. And even as we celebrate Martin Luther King Jr.'s life and enormous contribution to society, Barack Obama, the first ever African-American U.S. president, begins his seventh year in office. I never thought in my lifetime that I would see one of us aspiring to be the head of our nation, said Martin Luther King Jr.'s eldest sister, Dr. Christine King Farris. Mr. Obama leading us toward the presidency is like the promised land for us. Dr. King's life is well summed up in his own words. The quality